Good morning. As I have gotten older, I have developed a deeper appreciation for the music of Johnny Cash. And I'm proud to say I think one of my best works as a father is I have passed on my appreciation for Johnny Cash music to my boys, and now they have their own Johnny Cash playlists, which brings me great joy, great joy. One of my favorite Johnny Cash songs, though, is not one of his older songs. In fact, there's a way of dividing Johnny Cash fans by generation. Older Johnny Cash fans, when they think about their favorite Johnny Cash song, they think of something old back in the 1950s or 60s. But younger Johnny Cash fans, when they think of their favorite Johnny Cash song, they think of some of the stuff he recorded not long before he died. And one of my favorite Johnny Cash songs is one of those later recordings. And I'd like us to listen to a bit of it this morning.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt.
How's that for a positive, upbeat, energizing opener to a sermon? When you hear Cash sing that song, you hear the age in his voice. It's easy to think that song is about aging, that it's an old man looking back on his up and down life with disappointment and regret. And certainly if you've ever seen the video, which if you haven't, it'll break your heart, but you can go watch it on YouTube. But if you've ever seen the video, that would reinforce that interpretation of the song. But before this was a Johnny Cash song, it was a Nine Inch Nails song. And I'm guessing there are less Nine Inch Nails fans here than Johnny Cash fans this morning. It was a Nine Inch Nails song written by Trent Reznor. And Reznor wrote the song when he was in a pit of despair, mired in his own addiction to drugs. And every line of the song is powerful and haunting and disturbing in its own way, but I'd like us to focus just a bit on the opening lines. And I don't want to overanalyze these lyrics, but let's get a sense of what this song is really about. It says, I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. It's pain. That's the only thing that's real. He's numb, partly because of his addiction to drugs. The drugs have numbed all of his senses, can't even feel pain anymore, and yet the reason he's taken drugs is to numb the pain. And the next line describes that process and what that's about. There's a needle. It doesn't take away the pain. In fact, I remember everything. And then sinks deeper into despair. What have I become, my sweetest friend? Everyone I know goes away in the end. I'm all alone. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. You could have this meaningless life. And in the end, all you will have is hurt. I will make you hurt because that's all I've ever felt is hurt. Now, the song Hurt is about, among other things, pain. obviously. The pain we feel, the pain we try to escape, and the pain we also cause others. And the question I would like us to wrestle with a bit this morning is, what do we do with our pain? Life is full of pain. To be alive is to experience pain. Thousands of years ago, the Buddha said it, and then Jordan Peterson has been echoing it recently in his talks and in his writings. Life is suffering. And if you're not in pain right now, if you're not suffering from something right now, count yourself blessed and prepare yourself because it's coming. What do we do with our pain? Some of our pain is self-induced. Some of it is inflicted by others. Some of it's intentional. Some of it's accidental. There's the pain of grief and loss, the pain of guilt and shame, the pain of defeat and failure, the pain of disappointment and regret. There's the pain of being abandoned, of feeling alone, of being misunderstood or being mistreated. There's the pain of aging, and there's the pain of injury. Pain can be physical, it can be mental, it can be emotional, psychological, spiritual. What do we do with all the pain we acquire and accumulate over the course of a lifetime? And the answer from many of us is that we do our very best to numb or escape it. And there's no end to all the different ways we can try to numb or escape our pain. No end to all the different ways we try to manage and medicate our pain. We try to manage and medicate our pain with work or working out or with Facebook or other forms of social media. We try to manage and medicate our pain with entertainment, attending and watching sporting events, playing video games all night long, streaming, binging on TV shows. We try to medicate and manage our pain with sex, food, alcohol, drugs. And some of those activities we use to manage and medicate our pain are distracting us from it. And they keep us busy so we can't focus on the pain. For some of us, boredom is the real enemy, because boredom is the place where we come face to face with our pain. And so we'll do anything to keep from being bored, even if it means just staring at a screen for hours at a time, accomplishing nothing. But at least we're not bored. And some of the substances we use to numb the pain, try to make it all go away, like alcohol and drugs, but there are other ways to numb your pain. Exercise can have a numbing effect on your pain. A satirical website did a commercial parody for an app for runners that runners could use on their phone, plug in their headphones, and as they're running, the app tells them how far they've run, but it also supplies them with motivation for running. It reminds runners of why they're running. And some of the motivations, some of the motivations that would be piped into a runner's headphones would be, you're running because you're still single. You're running because you're living with constant shame. You're running because you have a disappointed father. And at the end of this parody commercial, one runner offers a testimonial. He said, I am so afraid that my friends don't really like me. So I just ran 27 miles, and now I feel nothing. Numb. Many of these activities, many of these substances that we use to numb or try to escape our pain, they're not inherently bad or evil. Many of them are created by God, and they are categorically good. They are blessings of creation, meant for our enjoyment, meant to be a blessing, meant to be used appropriately. Reminded of that line from Psalm 104. It's a psalm about the goodness of creation. And the psalmist in the middle of the psalm, he just thinks about some of the good things in life. He says, Psalm 104, verse 14, God makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for people to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens the heart, oil to make their faces shine, bread that sustains their hearts. The psalmist recognizes there's something positive about wine. It can be a good thing. It can be a lubricant for a celebration. It can enhance our joy. The psalmist is no teetotaler. It's okay. God made wine, and wine can help make us happy. It's good. The problem isn't with all the many different good things God created for our enjoyment that give us pleasure. The problem is with the ways we use and overuse and misuse and abuse these good things that God has created to numb our pain. The problem with a substance that gives us a pleasant feeling, that while it may numb the pain for a bit, it doesn't take care of the pain. It doesn't make it go away. It comes back. And the problem with exciting and engaging activities that fill us with pleasure and distract us from our pain is it doesn't really make the pain go away. We forget about the pain, but then it comes back and we remember everything. And when the pain comes back, we go back to our preferred method of medicating and managing our pain. And we keep going back again and again and again until we come to rely on it to help us get through the day or to get through the night. The very things we use to try and control our pain begin to control us. We become attached to them. We can't let go of them, and they will not let go of us. We need them to function. They become increasingly important to us. We become more focused, more obsessed with making sure we have them. We organize our lives around them. That's another word for worship. And you know, deep enough into this series on idolatry now, that when we turn something good into a god, that's idolatry. And another word for all the modern day idolatrous attachments we can develop over the course of a lifetime, another word for that is addiction. And addiction is, well, first, it is far too complex a topic for me to be able to do it justice in one sermon. So please forgive me if I leave something important unsaid this morning, or please forgive me if I oversimplify something that deserves more nuance. I'm just as nervous about today's message as I was the past two messages, but for completely different reasons. Because I know how personal and how painful, how devastating the topic of addiction is to some of you in this room. And the last thing I want to do is talk about addiction in some glib or cavalier fashion. I know there's a difference between opioid addiction and being addicted to work or exercise, or shopping. And to even use them as examples side by side one another feels inappropriate. But my goal this morning is to talk about all the many different forms and kinds of idolatrous attachments, addictions we can form over the course of a lifetime, not just one. But in doing that, I also don't want to trivialize the extreme forms of chemical addiction that are devastating families and communities across our country. It's real. It's terrible. We can't ignore it. Like all other false gods. False gods are false, not because they don't exist, but because they lie. They don't tell the truth. We can't trust them. Like all other false gods, idolatrous attachments never deliver all that they promise. They promise everything and then can leave us in the end with nothing. They promise to make things better, but over time they just make it worse. Facebook is a great example. It's an easy example. Many of us join Facebook in search of community. We wanted a sense of closeness. We want to be closer with other people. Maybe we wanted to reconnect with people from our past. And so we signed on to Facebook in search of community. And now there's a body of research. We've got tons of research on this that says the more time we spend on Facebook, instead of feeling closer to others, we actually feel more isolated, more alienated. We're more alone, more miserable. It was supposed to help, but it made it worse. And we can't stop logging on. We keep coming back to it, making ourselves feel even worse. I found in an online medical journal a fairly simple but very helpful to me definition of addiction. Define addiction as a psychological and physical inability to stop consuming a chemical, a drug, an activity, or a substance, even though it is causing psychological and physical harm. We can be addicted to substances, chemicals, but also activities and behaviors. That's why you can be addicted to technology and alcohol, to work and opioids, why you can be addicted to exercise and food. And the telltale sign of an addiction is that we can't stop doing it even though it's causing us harm. Harm to ourselves or harm to others. We sense it, we know it, we feel it, we want to stop and we can't. It's hurting, but we can't stop. It's addiction. And addiction is deadly serious because it can be deadly. An addict can die of an overdose. We know that story too well. An addict can also die by being so consumed by the screen in their hand that they step into moving traffic and get run over by a car. They can't stop looking. Theologically, addiction isn't sinful because God doesn't want us to experience pleasure. God doesn't want us to enjoy anything that's good or to feel good. Theologically, addiction is sinful because it makes us selfish. Addiction turns us inward on ourselves. We cut ourselves off from other people, the larger world. We become so obsessed and consumed that we're willing to sacrifice everything, our relationships, our families, our career, our health, our future, for that false god, that idol that promises to numb the pain. Now, when I say that addiction is sinful, I'm not saying that addicts are choosing to continue to sin. Remember the definition of addiction, it's an inability to stop. Addicts don't choose to keep going. Sin is a behavior, but sin is also a power that enslaves us. That's how Paul describes it in Romans. It's a power over us that enslaves us that we can't break free from on our own. Sin and addiction are these powers that hold on to us, and we don't have it within ourselves to break free by ourselves. We have to be rescued from sin, rescued from addiction. Salvation from sin, salvation from addiction, almost synonymous. We don't find it within ourselves. It has to come from somewhere, someone else. One test to see if a repetitive or habitual behavior is becoming addictive or already is an addiction. It's built into the definition, remember. A test is to stop doing it for a while. This is also known as fasting. It's a time-tested way of discerning idolatrous attachments in our lives. Can you stop? Can you take a break from Facebook? without sneaking a peek at the end of the day just to make sure you didn't miss out on the latest outrage? Can you leave your phone at home for an outing with your family? Can you leave your phone in the car when you go into a restaurant with your family? Can you go a month without sugar? Can you go a week without sugar? Can you go a week or a month without alcohol? Now, in the old days, they would say, okay, you've stopped preaching and now you're meddling. Because some of you at this point may be thinking, look, come on, what in the world? This series on idolatry? What? Let's just go back to talking about politics. That was a lot easier. The thing that I think you want me to try giving up, I don't want to give it up. Not because I'm addicted to it, but because I really, 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 really enjoy it. And I don't want to let go of it, not because I'm addicted to it, because it's just really, really helpful. Takes the edge off. Isn't that an interesting phrase? Takes the edge off. What are we taking the edge off of? Our frustration? Stress, our pain. I'm going to bring in a big gun now. I'm going to use a line from a Brené Brown book, Daring Greatly. I've quoted her before. I know some of you love her. I'm going to let her make this point, not me. But in Daring Greatly, she challenges us to examine what we do to take the edge off, but more than that, why we do it. She throw some examples out. She says, I'm going to argue that we need to examine the idea of taking the edge off, and that means considering the glasses of wine we drink while we're cooking dinner, eating dinner, and cleaning up after dinner, our 60-hour work weeks, the sugar, the fantasy football, that was rude, the prescription pills, and the 4 shots of espresso that we drink in order to clear the fog from the wine and Advil PM. I'm talking about you and me and the stuff we do every day just to get by. Just because we take something or use something or eat something or drink something every day to take the edge off doesn't mean we're addicted to it. But it does mean something. And I'm not suggesting that it's wrong to enjoy a good glass of wine at the end of the day, or to binge watch your favorite TV show on a lazy Saturday afternoon, or to chase a runner's high by running 5 miles every day. You do your thing. What I am suggesting, though, is it's also not wrong to explore the why behind the what. Why do we do these things regularly, daily, religiously? Why do we need to keep coming back to them to take the edge off the pain? And could it be that by habitually turning towards something to take the edge off, we're also habitually turning away from the someone who wants to do something with and about our pain? Early in Jesus' ministry, he's at a wedding. It's a big feast. It's a big party. And he turns a bunch of water into wine. Not cheap wine, good, expensive, high-quality wine. He does this to keep the hosts of the party from losing face because they didn't buy enough wine for the whole party. And in doing so, he re-injects fresh life into the party. And later on in Jesus' ministry, his critics accuse him of being a glutton and a drunkard. He eats too much, he drinks too much. Jesus was known to share table fellowship with all kinds of people, and they loved hanging out with him. He was not a killjoy. He was not against eating a feast or drinking a good glass of wine. He made a good glass of wine. Jesus knew how to enjoy the goodness of God's creation. But there is one time in his ministry when Jesus was offered a drink that he refused. It's in Mark chapter 15. Verse 22, it says, they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha. And then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh. But he did not take it. And they crucified him. The ancients used myrrh as a painkiller. It had a narcotic effect. Compassionate women in Jerusalem would often offer those who were about to be crucified wine mixed with myrrh as a way to dull their pain and ease their suffering. And I don't want to make too much of one detail from Jesus' crucifixion, but it appears to me from this scene that for Jesus, pain wasn't something always to be avoided or escaped or numbed. As Jesus is preparing to take the guilt and the shame of the world upon himself, as Jesus is prepared to suffer for others, he does not take the edge off of it. He refuses to dull or numb the pain. And when we see the way Jesus died on the cross, when we see the way Jesus suffered on the cross not only becomes a symbol of salvation for Christians, but it also becomes a reminder of God's willingness to meet us in our pain and suffering and share it with us. Share all of it, share the worst of it with us. The cross reminds us that we do not have to carry the burden of our pain alone. What do we do with our pain? What do we do with the pain that won't go away? Pain that demands to be felt. Pain that is there for a reason. Rather than try to numb it or escape from it, what if we sat with it? What if we acknowledged it? Owned it as real? Owned it as our pain? Doesn't matter if we caused it or someone else caused it. It's ours. It belongs to us now. And what if we sit with our pain long enough to explore the source of it? This is not pleasant. And this is not easy. But we explore the source of it. Why am I hurting right now? Why am I stressed right now? Why am I so frustrated right now? What is going on within me? Why does this hurt? Not distract ourselves from it. Not try to ignore it, but face it. And what if instead of trying to numb it or escape from it, in facing it, we also address it and begin to deal with it? Really deal with it. Bring it to the surface, understanding where it comes from, but also understanding what we need to do to begin to heal it. This likely means talking to someone else. A doctor, a therapist, a counselor, a trusted friend. We do not have to, nor are we supposed to, carry the burden of our pain alone. What if, instead of trying to numb or escape our pain, we interpret it as an invitation to the place where the God of all comfort meets us? God is already there in our pain, waiting for us to show up to it and in it. And of course, it shouldn't surprise us that when God does minister to us in our pain, when the God of all comfort comforts us in our pain, God often does this through other people who understand pain. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul begins his letter by saying, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who," he says, "comforts us in all our troubles," read pain, "so that we can comfort those in any trouble or pain with the comfort we ourselves receive from God." We receive comfort from God in our pain so that we can then share God's comfort with others in their pain. God ministers to us through the ministry of one another. One of the most important lessons the church can learn from 12-step groups is that the road from addiction to sobriety, the road from idolatrous attachments to freedom, is called community. We don't have to do this by ourselves, and it's those who have already learned how to entrust their lives, their pain, their addiction to a higher power, to God. They're the ones who are also most qualified to help others learn to do the same. We don't have to do this alone. And the things we do to try to numb the pain, it turns us inward. It isolates us from others, the very thing we need to keep walking. What do you do with your pain? God says, bring it to me. God says, bring it to me, and I will join you in it. And I will share it with you. I won't numb it. I won't distract you from it. I can't promise to take it away immediately. But I will redeem it. I will use it to teach you something. And I will use it to transform you into the kind of person who can then use your pain to bless others in their pain. What do we do with our pain? Please, don't take it to a false god or an idol that promises to numb us and yet ultimately makes us hurt that much more. Take it to the God of all compassion. Bring it to the God of all compassion who joins us in it and shares in our sufferings and who has promised to someday heal it. Heal all of it. The pain from a broken body, a broken heart, a broken mind, a broken soul. Let us take our pain to the God of all comfort, who will someday wipe the tears from our face and wipe pain from the face of the earth. Let us stand and sing.